The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. 7 minutes after 4 o'clock is our time. James Blend is producing. Clark Hilton is engineering today's program. Later in the 5 o'clock hour today, we'll talk with Emily Hibbard. She is an author. She's a documentary filmmaker and executive producer and narrator of The Honor Project. The Road to Fatherhood is an adventure. And she's on something of an adventure herself, bringing honor back to men and particularly fathers. We'll talk with her about that later in the 5 o'clock hour. Also today, we're going to be giving away, really starting to give away, 4 packs of tickets to the Portland Singing Christmas Tree, to the particular performance that KPDQ is sponsoring. So throughout the week, you'll have an opportunity to win those tickets. This is also the last week you can enjoy a ticket price discount of $5 per ticket with the Portland Singing Christmas Tree. And we'll give you all those details a bit later in today's program. Just a little heads up, we'll be giving away our first 4-pack of tickets in the first hour of today's program. Taking a look at some of the headlines, President Trump spoke forcefully on Sunday as the nation reeled from its latest episodes of senseless violence. At least 22 people killed in El Paso, Texas, with a suspect apprehended by police, and at least 9 killed in Dayton, Ohio, with a suspect fatally shot by responding officers. Hate has no place in our country, he declared, speaking to reporters in Morristown, New Jersey. He said the problem has been going on for years and years, and we have to get it stopped. By the way, there were 30-plus killings in Chicago as well. The president spoke of mental illness being a significant factor in many such events, referring to the perpetrators of such shocking crimes as very seriously mentally ill. He added, and by the way, only about 1 in 4 are. He added that he has been conferring with Attorney General William Barr, FBI Director Christopher Wray, and members of Congress, and planned an additional statement on the shootings, which he gave on Monday morning. We're going to take care of the problem, the president vowed, as more signs emerged of the public's increasing frustration with preventable violence. In Dayton, attendees of a vigil for that city's victims confronted Ohio Governor Mike DeWine with a chant, "Do something." And the gunman killed by police in Dayton, Ohio, after fatally shooting 9 people, including his sister, and wounding more than 24 others, displayed signs of hostility years earlier, his former high school classmates say. According to reports, Connor Betts was suspended twice back in high school after compiling a hit list of classmates he wanted to kill and a rape list of those he wanted to assault. A former principal of the high school in Bellbrook, Ohio, told the Dayton Daily News that he would not dispute the information that the former classmates revealed to reporters. He knew he wasn't normal, one former female classmate said of the shooter. He and I talked at length about him getting help. Meanwhile, at a news conference on Sunday, just hours after the carnage, Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal and other authorities said the shooter was wearing a mask, bulletproof vest, and earplugs when he opened fire outside a bar using a rifle capable of holding at least 100 rounds. There's nothing in this individual's history or record that would have precluded him from purchasing that firearm, the chief said. Often our emotions respond more to spectacle than to data. That's a statement from popular astrophysicist Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He tweeted on Sunday afternoon. He was making a point that the public gets upset about horrific deaths like those in Texas and Ohio over the weekend, but less so about more common preventable deaths. For example, he wrote that in the same span of time, 34 people died in mass shootings over the past week. About 500 people died because of medical errors, 200 because of auto accidents. But mass shooting death gets far more media attention because they're far more shocking. Social media users, however, weren't appreciating his argument. A person can be both intellectually brilliant and practically asinine, wrote one. It was an awkward return to negative headlines for Tyson, who earlier this year resumed his hosting role on 2 TV shows, Cosmos and Star Talk, after being cleared following a sexual misconduct investigation. Well, he had the smallest tomb in Egypt's Valley of the Kings, but it was also estimated to be the most expensive. Now, the golden coffin of the legendary King Tut, Tutankhamun, will undergo restoration for the first time. According to the Associated Press, Minister Khalid al-Anani told reporters that the planned 8-month-long restoration is due to the extreme fragility of the coffin, which has remained untouched since 1922 when the 3,000-year-old tomb was discovered by British archaeologists Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon. Tutankhamun ruled Egypt for approximately 10 years, was around 19 years old when he died. Experts suspect he died of gangrene caused by a broken leg. And on this day in history, in 1884, the cornerstone for the Statue of Liberty is laid. On this day in 1861, President Lincoln, he signs the Revenue Act of 1861, the first income tax in America. And on this day in 1914, the first electric traffic light was installed in Cleveland. And on this day in 2010, the Senate confirmed Elena Kagan to be an associate justice to the U.S. Supreme Court. The vote was 63-37. And on this date in 2013, the Washington Post agreed to sell the Washington Post to Jeff Bezos for $250 million. That was in cash, by the way. Well, two more victims of Saturday's mass shooting in El Paso on Monday morning has raised the number of fatalities in the massacre to 22, according to officials. The mass shooting, one of the deadliest in modern U.S. history, unfolded at a Walmart at 11 a.m. on Saturday as a 21-year-old suspect allegedly opened fire in the store, initially killing at least 20 and injuring another 26. Among those 26, now two have been added to the died as a result of their injuries list. Police and hospital officials announced that two additional people who were wounded in that attack died, and the Walmart was nearly near capacity at the time of the shooting, with hundreds of shoppers inside along with 100 employees during the busy back-to-school shopping season. The shooter was booked on capital murder charges, authorities said Sunday. His alleged crimes were being investigated as domestic terrorism. Officials were also looking into whether hate crime charges against him are appropriate. The El Paso District Attorney, Jamie Esparza, said his office was seeking the death penalty against the suspect. The loss of life is so great. We certainly have never seen this in our community. We are a very safe community, he told reporters at a news conference on Sunday. We pride ourselves on the fact that we are so safe, and certainly this community is rocked, shocked, and saddened by what has happened here yesterday. Separately, hours later, a gunman wearing a mask, bulletproof vest, earplugs, and carrying a rifle capable of holding at least 100 rounds also opened fire outside a bar in Dayton, Ohio. At least 9 people were killed and 27 others were wounded, including the sister of the shooter. Some victims of the El Paso mass shooting have been identified. Among those killed was a 60-year-old man who was at the self-checkout line while his wife was in the restroom, a 15-year-old weeks away from starting 10th grade, and 6 Mexican citizens. A mother of 3 who was shielding her 2-year-old son from gunfire was fatally shot. Her husband was, too. El Paso Mayor Dee Margo said the city's large Hispanic population played a part of why this community was targeted. We are the largest U.S. city on the Mexican border, he said. Our region is a population inclusive of what is Mexican and southern New Mexican of 2.5 million people. El Paso was 84% Hispanic to begin with, end quote. Police said investigators were examining a manifesto that may have been written by the suspect and would indicate a nexus to a hate crime, but further information was not immediately clear. That story is continuing to develop. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll take a quick break, but we will return.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 19 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. So a summation of some of the headlines over the weekend. A white supremacist kills 22 at Walmart. A self-described leftist socialist kills 9 in Daytona. And 25 are shot and killed in Chicago in 4 hours. Chicago nearly toppled them both with another all-too-common deadly weekend. Lord, help us. Well, the man who police say committed the deadly shooting spree in El Paso, Texas, is believed to have published an anti-immigrant manifesto minutes before the attack. Law enforcement officials said they were confident that an anti-immigrant screed posted online belongs to the shooter, the 21-year-old, who they said is responsible for Saturday's mass shooting at a Walmart in El Paso, leaving at least 22 people dead and 24 wounded or injured. The nearly 2,400-word manifesto outlines reasons for launching that attack, breaking down the political and economic motivations. The entire diatribe argues that U.S. leaders, both Republican and Democrats, are guilty of allowing unfettered immigration into the country and that violent action is needed to preserve the white population. That is being investigated, which will certainly have an impact on the charges to be brought against him, although they're seeking the death penalty. I won't go on with more from that screed because I don't think it's worthy of our time, but it does give you some insight into what motivated him in his actions. Well, the gunman in the deadly rampage in Dayton, Ohio, was wearing a mask, a bulletproof vest, earplugs, and was carrying a rifle capable of holding at least 100 rounds when he opened fire outside a bar, killed 9, including his sister, and injured more than 24, one in critical condition, police said on Sunday. Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal told reporters in a news conference on Sunday afternoon that the gunman, identified as a 25-year-old, showed up to the city's Oregon district around 5th Street with his sister and a friend on Saturday night. He added the three separated at some point between when they arrived and when the shooter opened fire, saying it's unknown what happened during that time. Now, we don't know if the sister was targeted or if her death was inadvertent, but the shooter said police officers in the area engaged him seconds after the second gunshots were heard, and the gunman was neutralized within 30 seconds after the first of dozens of rounds. The shooter was shot and killed by police before he entered the Ned Pepper's bar. He was using a .223 caliber rifle. At 1:05 a.m., officers were patrolling the Oregon District during bar closing time and heard gunfire. They observed a large crowd running away from the gunfire. The officers immediately advanced toward the gunfire and within approximately 20 seconds engaged the suspect, who was actively firing and attempting to enter a crowded establishment. The threat was neutralized in approximately 30 seconds of the subject firing his first shot. However, because he had an automatic capacity, he was able to kill certainly more than one would anticipate in that short period of time. The shooter added that, Detective Beal added that the shooter had gotten inside. If he had gotten inside, the results would have been more catastrophic. There's nothing in this individual's history or record that would have precluded him from purchasing that firearm. The officer told reporters that the shooter had two guns with him, adding that a shotgun was left in the vehicle at the time of the shooting. The perpetrator was killed by police less than a minute after he opened fire with that .223. Police confirmed early Sunday that the shooter's 22-year-old sister, the sister that he had transported to that location, was among the 9 killed. His sister was not the first person killed, but among the initial victims. She was with a companion who was injured in the attack. They have not yet been able to question that individual. The detective said investigators have had a chance to speak with the friend, but did not disclose what was discussed, saying the investigation is ongoing. And in addition to the horrific shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend, 51 people were shot in Chicago and 7 of the victims died. This follows several weekends in the Windy City in which dozens of people were shot, including the July 12th through 15th weekend in which 56 people were shot and 11 died. However, the media didn't express nationwide outrage over that gun violence, and politicians didn't blame individuals or rhetoric for that violence. There is plenty of it going on all around us for a variety of reasons on both sides of the political spectrum. And rather than focus on that, I would like to at least hope that we would focus on a solution. We'll continue to follow that story. Well, in the wake of weekend shootings, with the 31 dead in Texas and Ohio and those in Chicago, the president called for bipartisan action that includes increased background checks to catch red flags of potential shooters. He also denounced hatred and white supremacy. Open wounds cannot heal if we are divided. We must seek real bipartisan solutions, he said. We have to do that in a bipartisan manner that will truly make America safer and better for all. Well, speaking from the diplomatic reception room of the White House in his first formal address since the two shootings, which also left more than 50 wounded or injured, the president talked about a culture of violence pushed by social media, video games, and about making reforms in mental health care. These barbaric slaughters are an assault on our communities, an attack upon our nation, and an attack against all humanity. We are outraged and sickened by the monstrous evil, the cruelty, the hatred, the bloodshed, and the terror. The police said the 21-year-old gunman killed 22, injuring 24 others at the Walmart. And again, within 13 hours, police said the 24-year-old shooter in Ohio wounded 27 and killed 9, including his sister. Federal prosecutors are treating the shooting in El Paso, which left 20 dead on Saturday, as an act of domestic terrorism and possible hate crime that could carry the death penalty. They've already announced that they're going to seek the death penalty given the nature of this mass shooting. We're also treating it as a domestic terrorism case, they said, and we're going to do what we do to terrorists in this country, which is deliver swift and certain justice. That's a quote from John Bash, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Texas, in a press conference on Sunday with regard to the events. Well, how should Christians respond to mass shootings? Max Lucado was asked that question, and in the Christian Post today offered some insight, saying that in the wake of mass shootings in El Paso and in Dayton, pastor and author Lucado is urging the U.S. to welcome Jesus into the midst of this turbulent time instead of responding with fear and anger. Over the weekend, at least 29 people died. Dozens more were wounded. The San Antonio pastor and best-selling author noted that many are responding to this dark season of bloodshed with anger and fear, but cautioned against that being an unconstructive way to respond to such violence that is inevitable, not necessarily with the use of guns, but with the nature of sin. Anger, he writes, is the choice of many. Anger at politicians, at the NRA, at God. We become bitter and sour toward this world, toward one another, he wrote in an op-ed. Fear is another option. Lock the doors, close the windows, avoid every shadow, every dark alley. But the Bible offers direction on how to respond with these kinds of storms. He pointed to John 6, where Jesus walked on the water to join his disciples in their boat in the middle of a terrifying storm. Amid the disciples' fear and anxiety, Jesus said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." That's John 6, verses 19 and 20, where you'll find that narrative. The literal translation of what Jesus said is, "I am. Don't be afraid," and that's in caps, "I am." I am is God's name. If God had a calling card, it would contain this imprint in capital letters, "I am." This is the title of steadfast steadiness and power. When we wonder if God is coming, he answers with his name, "I am." When we wonder if he is able, he declares, "I am." When we see nothing but darkness, feel nothing but doubt, and wonder if God is near or aware, the welcome answer from Jesus is this, as it was then, "I am." He advised readers to pause and invite God to tell us his name. Our greatest need is his presence. Yes, we want this storm to pass. We want the winds still. Yes, we want to know, we need to know, we must know that the great I am is coming. The pastor pointed out that when the disciples invited Jesus into the boat, they reached their destination. Let's follow the example of the disciples. Welcome Jesus into the midst of this turbulent time. Don't let the storm turn you inward. Let it turn you upward. Listen and see if you don't hear him say, "I am with you in the storm." Well, on Saturday afternoon, as the gunman opened fire outside of a Walmart in a busy shopping center in El Paso, people died. The same happened in Ohio. Hours later, in Dayton. The shootings were the 21st and 22nd mass killings of 2019 in the U.S. and followed a week in Gilroy, California, Brooklyn, New York, and Philadelphia were struck by gun violence. Over the weekend, a number of Christian leaders, artists, and pastors took to social media to express their sorrow over the shootings. "It is in this evil world we must stand strong," tweeted Bible teacher Beth Moore. "It is in this madness we must think soundly. It's amid these dangers our hearts must neither melt nor harden. It's here and now. We who follow Jesus must be brave and bold to love and truth, defending the defenseless and not the defensible." Franklin Graham, son of evangelist Billy Graham, wrote that the number of victims of the mass shooting is much higher than the headlines reveal, because each mother, each father, each sister and brother, every wife, every husband is also a victim of the heinous and senseless evil unleashed by two murderous gunmen. Their loved ones have been stolen from them, he stated. As we mourn with these families and communities, let's continue to sincerely lift them up in prayers before the Lord. He is the only one who can comfort and wholly heal their broken heart. Craig Groeschel, pastor of Life Church, tweeted, "Please join me in prayer for all those affected by the targeted shooting in El Paso, Texas. My heart breaks for this community. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit." Psalm 34:18. Also on Twitter, Christian NFL star Benjamin Watson wrote, "In the face of evil and tragedy, be not weary in well-doing. Never cease to be moved by the suffering of others. Mourn with those who mourn." Well, it is a challenging season, and how we respond matters, not only personally and in our communities, but certainly in terms of public policy. And one can only hope and pray that there will be constructive conversation and perhaps policy that might bring us closer to limiting the number of incidents similar to this. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back 37 minutes after 4 o'clock. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show, brought to you in part, by the way, by Zero Res. Well, as promised, we want to give a four-pack of tickets away to, well, a KPDQ listener. Portland Singing Christmas Tree features 26 new songs, Miss America 2002 Katie Harmon, 300 Voice Choir, Timothy Greenidge, Cinematic Nativity, The Jefferson Dancers, and I might get to do a song or two. We want to give away a family four-pack of tickets to see Portland Singing Christmas Tree on Friday, November 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Now, make note of the date. Friday, November 22nd, 7:30 p.m. Now, the way the calendar works this year, the tree starts a week earlier than it typically does, so don't miss out because you haven't checked the calendar. Anyway, we want to give away four tickets to caller number four, and the number to call, 800-845-2162, 800-845-2162. Again, we're giving away four tickets, a pack of four tickets to see the Portland Singing Christmas Tree for the Friday, November 22nd performance. That's at 7:30 p.m. once again at the Keller Auditorium. And I want to also let you know that this is the last week to save $5 on advanced purchase tickets. So you can find out more at the Portland Singing Christmas Tree's website as well. Those dates are the 22nd, 23rd and 24th, and then the following weekend, the 29th, 30th, and December 1st. So make note of that. And again, you can either go to kpdq.com for all those important details or the Singing Christmas Tree's website. 800-845-2162, caller number four. Our first four pack of tickets to this year's Singing Christmas Tree. Two weekends only, so make note of it. All right. I noted that Taylor Schumann, who is a shooting survivor, had something to say about those who are critical of the phrase, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with you. He says we need more than thoughts and prayers in the immediate aftermath. Let me just make a brief comment on the phrase thoughts and prayers. Now, for some people, it's sort of an offhand comment that is made. You know, we don't know what else to do because we're not in a situation we can directly comfort those who have been injured or whose lives have been lost. So we extend our thoughts and prayers. And then there are those who are serious about the notion of praying for the comfort of those who have been victims, and to pray that those who are responsible for whatever the tragedy was, whatever role they might have played, that they might be brought to justice and all of that. So that it's not just a matter of a thought that one has and you hang on a thought for a few minutes, and that's, you're actually engaging in conversation with the one who's actually in a position to do something about it all. And so prayers are a real thing, but this phrase of thoughts and prayers that's often thrown out there is, in many cases, a meaningless way of saying, my heart breaks for you, but there's nothing I can do. Anyway, this individual, Taylor Schumann, has actually been shot, was a survivor, and says this: "I have a complicated relationship with thoughts and prayers," in quotes. The phrase has become the familiar refrain after each mass shooting, echoing in tweets and statements offering condolences to families and communities shaken by tragedy. Like many others affected by gun violence, I can't help but feel frustrated and cynical when I hear another line about thoughts and prayers. I think in defense of those who use the phrase, when you are an observer from some distance, there's absolutely nothing you can do. That's all that you have, is to try to say that I have compassion, my heart is broken with you. So I wouldn't be quite so critical of everyone. I think for policymakers, there might be greater frustration because they're actually in a position to maybe have some influence on the potential of future events. But nonetheless, he goes on to say, "It's been 6 years since I was shot when a gunman opened fire at New River Community College in Virginia. With the news of each mass shooting, each child dead after finding a loaded weapon in their home, and each suicide or senseless gun death, I wonder if action from those in power will ever follow the thoughts and prayers. As a survivor, I believe in action. At the same time, I believe in the power of prayer. I know firsthand what living through a shooting does to a mind and what a bullet does to a body. And I believe that my recovery and healing is a direct result of prayers that were prayed for me and over me." So the writer, Taylor Schumann, is not discounting prayers, but the use of this sort of catchphrase that so often passes for nothing can be done. "Being a survivor doesn't mean I can single-handedly solve the crisis of gun violence. What I can offer, though, is insight into some specific ways to pray for survivors as one part of our response to gun violence." And Taylor writes this: "Pray for physical wounds, pains, and future treatments, because this isn't a singular event for those who are the victims here, those who are survivors. Managing bullet wounds is often a process of trial and error where it can take days for doctors to figure out how to provide comfort. Some survivors face years of recovery, including surgeries and physical rehabilitation. Pray that they would experience a relief from the physical pain, that the lasting effects of the wounds would be minimal, and that they would have the strength to persevere through the treatments to come." And again, it's not a singular event for them. "Pray for their invisible wounds. Survivors have witnessed the unimaginable, oftentimes seeing people they love also wounded or killed. These are images that will never leave their minds, whether or not they were wounded. There are processing their near-death experience and wondering what their new reality will be. Many survivors will deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression. Pray for their emotional trauma that they're dealing with. Pray that they would have access to counseling, therapy, whatever type of mental health treatment that they need." So the wounds of those who are literally struck and those who are bystanders, those who are extended family and so on. Pray for wisdom for doctors, nurses, and all the medical specialists they encounter. Pray for shielding from photos and information of the shooter. "I will never forget," he writes, "waking up and seeing the face of the person who shot me next to my picture on the front page of the newspaper, or seeing my name scroll across the ticker on the national news. As videos and photos make their way into the coverage, pray that the survivors are shielded from hearing about the shooter and reliving their trauma over and over again. Pray about nightmares and for the ability to sleep and rest. For me," Taylor writes, "one of the hardest things in the days following the shooting was sleeping. I was terrified to close my eyes, and when I did, I suffered through nightmares. After a significant trauma, the body needs sleep. Pray that the survivors are able to rest without fear. Pray for financial provision for medical costs and other needs. They can be great. The financial impact of being shot is devastating for families, especially if the person hurt was the family wage earner or will live with a lifelong disability. Please pray for financial provision for hospital bills, ongoing care, materials needed to function well, and ongoing mental health treatment. Pray for guidance and support during the legal process. In incidents where the shooters are taken into custody, survivors face a long and tedious legal process full of court proceedings. They'll be asked to testify about the worst day of their lives and forced to listen to traumatizing details. Pray that they would have a strong support system for the long haul. Pray for support from other survivors. Pray against re-traumatization after other shootings. And keep praying." Taylor writes, "If I can convince you to do just one thing on this list, I hope it is this one. Keep praying. For many survivors, including myself, the day of the shooting is not the hardest day. The hardest day comes later, when you're confronted with your new reality in the aftermath. When the cards stop coming, when people stop asking how you are, when the news cycle changes, you begin to feel forgotten and isolated." People praying for you months and years after the shooting is a significant way to show support. God knows the needs of survivors, so I don't believe it's necessary to know exactly what to pray for in order to pray. However, when we acknowledge the specific needs of others, we are better able to empathize with them, love them, and serve them well. We're also better able to recognize the deep and ongoing trauma of gun violence that lasts long after the news cameras are gone. I hope that this list helps you pray for victims in El Paso and Dayton, and for that matter, Chicago and elsewhere. And while I pray this isn't there isn't a next time, I hope it's helpful then, too. Some good, sound advice. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
51 minutes after 4 o'clock, you're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. A reminder, coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Emily Hibbard. She's an author, she's a documentary filmmaker, and executive producer and narrator of The Honor Project. The Road to Fatherhood is an Adventure. It's a DVD that features 20 men, all of whom are fathers and have made the decision that this is going to be their priority in life. They tell their stories, it's inspiring, and it brings honor back to fatherhood. So she's coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Well, the FCC chairman has taken on robocalls, saying we want to make sure consumers are protected. The chairman, Ajit Pai, on the agency's effort to take on robocalls, said the Federal Communications Commission that voted to approve laws that ban fraudulent text messages and international robocalls last week should help with consumers. The new rules, in effect, neutralize loopholes in the Truth in Caller ID Act that banned spoofing domestic calls, but made it hard for the FCC to prosecute against perpetrators of scam text messages and international calls. Well, now the FCC can monitor and penalize bad actors behind these types of schemes. Well, the FCC chair, he proposed the legislation earlier this summer, and he announced the approval, acknowledging the FCC has received tens of thousands of complaints about spoofing just this year. That's what they're calling these robocalls and texts. Caller ID spoofing, which uses area code similar to the receiver's own, makes it more likely that the call receiver is going to pick up. The AARP Fraud Watch Network estimates that about 48 billion robocalls were made last year, and that number is rising. These estimates are up 57% from last year, and of course that would only continue. To address this mounting problem, the House last week also passed a bipartisan bill that requires carriers to authenticate every call and to offer opt-out blocking for free. Well, the Federal Trade Commission has increased enforcement by bringing lawsuits against groups responsible for more than a billion robocalls. And while legislative changes are being made for consumer protection, the FCC recommends Americans add their phone numbers to the National Do Not Call Registry. You can do that at www.donotcall.gov. It opens a window. You can follow the prompts from there. You can also call 888-382-1222. That's 888-382-1222 from the phone number being registered. Now, they estimate that this step will reduce telemarketing calls within 31 days of registering that number. So it's not immediate, but you can expect after about a month plus a day, you're going to see fewer, if not see an end to robocalls altogether. Consumers can also assist in federal telemarketing scam investigations by filing a complaint with the FCC if they believe they've received an illegal call or text, which is sometimes difficult to tell because if you don't pick up, which you don't want to do, you can't really identify what the source was. But nonetheless, at least someone is addressing the issue. Well, while North Korea is making headlines for its missile tests, nuclear program, and its various apocalyptic pronouncements of the dictator Kim Jong-un, one of Pyongyang's most horrific tools of abuse rarely gets any attention at all, and it's largely unchecked, the ongoing implementation of forced abortions. Well, experts who spoke to local networks, or not local, national networks, said that China is complicit in the abuse and have said it causes one can only imagine. Involuntary abortions are part of that. North Korean officials engage in outright infanticide as well. Terrifying reports from female defectors depict ongoing forced abortions after they fled to what they thought was freedom in China. So even those who escape and believe that they finally have the opportunity to experience some modicum of freedom are repatriated back to North Korea by authorities in China. That's what Olivia Enos, who's senior policy analyst for the Asian Studies Center, says. Other women from North Korea recount having aborted babies born alive for giving birth in ordinary prison camps, only to have border agents smother or drown their babies before their very eyes. One analyst and journalist and a former Air Force officer for the Republic of Korea, Kim Dong-hyun, added, there has been no marked improvements with regard to North Korea's human rights record in recent years when it comes to forced abortions. And we think about abortion in China, but perhaps have given little or no thought to what's happening in North Korea. These women are treated like animals, have been put through forced abortions, and it's done in many ways. This is inhumane and a serious problem. Indeed, the barbarity allegedly knows no bounds, as Kim explicitly detailed. Pregnant women can be made to lie on the ground, then guards put a long piece of wood on their stomach. They pick two people for the job. These two people could be the son of the woman or her husband or any relative. They stand on top of the wood like a seesaw. Using a burning iron is another method. I won't go into many more details, but these are barbaric and brutal. We're not talking about a clinical abortion. We're talking about women being tortured until that child dies. A woman can die from this punishment, and often if she survives, cannot walk properly, and they go into greater detail. He recounted a haunting tale of one pregnant woman who escaped North Korea to China, but was later caught by authorities there and expelled to her homeland after discovering she was pregnant. He stressed how she was kicked multiple times in order for her to lose her baby, which she did. He says that's only a few of the horrors that pregnant women endure there. Babies are aborted without anesthesia. Some reported having soldiers jump on their stomachs until the baby simply was extracted. Others by having various instruments inserted and so on. A 2014 report delivered to the UN Rights Council underscored that blood tests are routinely conducted on all repatriated women, and those found to be pregnant are made to endure abortion through a number of methods, inflicting trauma, which, again, I won't go into detail. The report also pointed to cases in which a mother was able to carry her baby to full term, though with no medical assistance, but prison guards then suffocated and drowned the child once the child was born. There is a widespread prevalence of forced abortion and infanticide against repatriated mothers and their children. The vast majority are forced abortions upon these women. They're carried out on the premise that all repatriated pregnant women could be carrying babies conceived by Chinese men. The women are not asked what ethnicity their father, the father of the child, was, husband or otherwise. Unconfirmed reports surfaced as early as 2015 that North Korean healthcare workers, not guards or other authorities, presided over detention facilities, were given a directive to discontinue these abortions, but that has apparently not been the case. And those are, according to reports, offered by women who have actually escaped. Meanwhile, brushing aside repeated entreaties from the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo for a meeting, North Korea was a no-show at a diplomatic forum in Bangkok. The Secretary of State still holds out hope for renewed talks with North Korea. Human rights issues have not been at the forefront of those conversations, but nonetheless, these conversations apparently are continuing between the United States and North Korea. And we'll continue to follow that story. A new study published in the journal Frontiers in Neuroscience provides evidence of the harmful biological behavioral effects of drug-induced abortions. Now, this was going to be the panacea. You could walk into a drugstore, you could purchase an abortion-inducing drug, and in the matter of hours, a matter of days, the pregnancy will have ended. But there's a new study that reveals that there is, aside from the fact that an abortion occurs, harm related to this medication. Using rat subjects, the study suggests that pregnancy termination at midterm induces significant negative biological and behavioral changes. The study found that drug-induced abortion presented more negative effects than a spontaneous abortion through miscarriage. And finally, the study found there were positive benefits to carrying the baby to term. Well, one could have imagined that to be the case, but nonetheless, new study pointing out that there is a downside aside from abortion to the inducing pill. We've got news and traffic coming up at the top of the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll hear from Emily Hibbard. She's an author. She's a documentary filmmaker and executive producer and narrator of The Honor Project. The Road to Fatherhood is an Adventure. She uses the word honor deliberately because she wants to bring honor back to manhood and to fatherhood. And this is a sweet project that focuses on 20 men who are all fathers and have made the commitment, regardless of their own upbringing, to be good fathers and raising their children. We'll tell you more about the documentary and how you can see it. So stick with us. She'll be with us in our next segment. Well, the Babylon Bee is a Christian satirical website. And like The Onion, it does satire. Well, interestingly enough, Snopes decided to take on, and it's not really clear if they understood that it was a satirical site, but this past week, in the most unintentionally hilarious way, the fact-checking website, Snopes, became upset at a satirical news article on the Babylon Bee that Snopes actually fact-checked. The satirical article that became the focus of Snopes' ire was entitled, "Georgia Lawmaker Claims Chick-fil-A Employee Told Her to Go Back to Her Country, Later Clarifies He Actually Said My Pleasure." And it's a take on a conflict that a lawmaker had in a grocery store in which, you know, it's one of those lines where you're only supposed to have 10 items or less. And one accused the other of having told her, the African-American accused the Caucasian man of telling her to go back to her country. It turns out she was the one who actually told him. But nonetheless, so the headline, as is, you know, what happens on a satirical website, reflected that, making a joke of the whole thing. For anyone following the news over the last week, the piece was clearly intended to mock the Georgia Democrat state representative who posted a video on Twitter of herself sobbing hysterically and claiming she feared for her life when a white man assaulted her with words, allegedly telling her to go back where she came from. As I pointed out, he'd actually been the victim of her ire, and she told him to go back where he came from. Well, further investigation by the Atlanta media and police discovered that the Caucasian man who assaulted Thomas with his words was actually a fellow Democrat of Cuban descent who took umbrage at Thomas going through the public express lane with more than 10 items and then confronted her. And of course, the conflict ensued. Well, when video was released showing the Democratic representative was actually the aggressor, confirmed by the manager of the store, who was also an African-American woman, who witnessed the altercation and reported that it was Thomas who told the Cuban man to go back where he came from and not the other way around. Thomas admitted her story might not be completely factual, but she was still the victim because it's profitable these days to be the victim. Well, Snopes declared the Bee's article was especially confusing for some readers, however, as it closely mirrored the events of a genuine news story, which is what satire does, clarifying that Thomas's altercation took place at a Publix, not a Chick-fil-A, and with a customer, not a store employee. Well, when you are angry, humorless, bitter busybodies, and many tyrants, I suppose this actually merits fact-checking. Well, a dramatic advance in satellite imaging technology in the last 10 years of privacy advocates, they're worried about 24-hour surveillance. Right now, U.S. federal regulators have kept things in check so that while commercial satellite imagery is powerful enough, for instance, to see a car, it's not detailed enough to identify the make and model, according to a report from the MIT Technology Review. But satellite companies say they keep a person's data separate from any identifying characteristics. Well, the risks arise not only from the satellite images themselves, but the fusion of Earth observation data with other sources of data so that we might be surveilled all the time. Now, I've never imagined myself so interesting that anyone would ever want to surveil me, but nonetheless, the capacity seems to be drawing nearer. Then there's the sheer volume of satellites overhead. Imaging company Planet Labs confirmed that it has 140 imaging satellites currently in orbit. The report says this is enough to pass over every place on Earth once a day. Well, even the planet's highest resolution imagery, it remains impossible to distinguish individual people, car number plates, or otherwise identifying information. So at least for now, we're safe, in quotes. Our imagery is ideal for monitoring large-scale change on a daily basis. That includes seeing daily change across buildings and roads, forests, agriculture, bodies of water, and more, says a spokesperson from Planet Labs. Meanwhile, satellite imagery is getting closer to a level that investors and businesses are going to want to exploit. The goal, Mapbox's Charlie Lloyd tells MIT Technology, is to make a living map of Earth. The publication points out that the observational satellites can do, well, good too. They can help farmers monitor a crop growth cycle, geologists better examine rock textures, human rights organizers track refugee movement, and of course, other satellites do things like helping meteorologists predict the weather and making our phones and televisions work most efficiently. But the concern is that satellites are starting to watch our every move. How boring that must ultimately be. Meanwhile, a former Google engineer claims that he was blacklisted, bullied, and ultimately fired by a tech giant, all because of his conservative beliefs. And the Wall Street Journal published the report. Well, Kevin Czernecki told the journal that after his posts to the tech giant internal message board in early 2015 annoyed some of his colleagues, he received an official warning from Google's human rights. His conduct had reportedly been deemed disrespectful and insubordinate. The journal reports that around the time a senior official from the company wrote on the message board that he had added the engineer to a written blacklist of Google employees he wouldn't work with. Well, Czernecki, he spent the next 3 years fighting the Mountain View, California-based firm over the alleged violations and arguing that conservative employees were being treated unfairly, according to the report, which cites interviews, documents, copies of posts on the company's internal message boards. He was fired in June of last year after Google told him that he was terminated for misuse of the company's equipment, including its software system for remote access. Czernecki, who describes himself as a whistleblower, maintains that he was terminated for his outspoken conservative views that were not welcome. Historically, there's been a lot of bullying at Google, he says. There's a big political angle, and they treat the two sides differently, and they're committed to the outcome of the next presidential election, seeing to it that one side wins over the other. And with the use of their algorithms, other technology, and their political bent, he says they have the capacity to make a difference. Czernecki was fired for multiple violations of company policies, according to Google. He's also reportedly filed complaints with the National Labor Relations Board. Some of the complaints were denied, but the original is pending, according to the journal. Up next, we're going to talk with Emily Hibbard, author, documentary filmmaker, and executive producer and narrator of The Honor Project.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show. Well, according to my next guest, and really lots of resources, the data is clear. Fathers are a pivotal force for good in the lives of their sons and their daughters. In fact, boys who are raised with a biological father in the home do better academically, they commit fewer crimes, they're incarcerated less frequently, they engage in early sexual activity less often, and they're healthier physically and emotionally. Fathers help boys moderate their anger, express emotions, and use self-control, and they set the standard for daughters about how men are supposed to treat them. Well, documentary filmmaker Emily Hibbard is with me in studio. She set out to explore just how fathers are learning to cope and thrive in an underappreciative culture. She says, I'm grateful for the childhood my own dad allowed me to have, and in fact, he's featured in the documentary. I especially enjoyed that part. And she does more than a dozen interviews with fathers for the Honor Project documentary. These men have discovered the joy of investing time, wisdom, and experience in the next generation, and it shows. They just tell their own stories, share their joys and challenges of fathering, and it is a wonderful documentary. She didn't post a casting call for these men, and we'll learn more about how she came up with this cast of characters that make up this remarkable film. Emily Hibbard joins us. She is a native of California. She's traveled to all seven continents. She did so by her 30th birthday. She studied modern political thought at Oxford University, earned a bachelor's degree in history and political science from Azusa Pacific University, and received a master's degree in public administration from California State University, Northridge. She is the author of Starting Your Nonprofit. She joins us today to talk about her documentary, Honor Project, The Road to Fatherhood is an adventure. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this is really a remarkable film because it is simple. It tells the stories of men who are parenting their children, are committed to doing it well. And these are stories you're not hearing in very many places, if at all.
Not at all. There's three things that contributed to me wanting to do a documentary on regular guys. One is my own dad. You know, as you've seen in the documentary, he's quite a character. I grew up with that. So when I started hearing all what we're hearing in this conversation, not only in this country, but other places around the world, is this thing called toxic masculinity and how men are horrible. And I didn't grow up with that. I'm not familiar with that. Also, for the past 15 years, I've been working with women transitioning out of the commercial sex industry. Mm. Imagine ex-porn star who got radically saved, gave her life to Christ. And all of those women that I've been working with, they all have the same relationship with their dad. It's bad. It's really bad. And I wanted to confront the conversation that we're having in this country by just showing and sharing, here's 20 guys who are in my life that contrasts much of what we're seeing in the media today.
Yeah. I mentioned a moment ago, you didn't send out a casting call. These are men whose stories you're not just hearing about. These are men whose stories you have observed. You know their reputation. You know their character. You know something of their children. Tell us a little bit about these 20 men. That includes your father.
Yeah, these are friends of mine. These are personal friends of mine. The older guys, you know, the ones in the 60s and their 70s, those guys are married to women who have been mentoring me for a number of years. So casting for this documentary was really easy. I basically grabbed my iPhone and went through my phone book and called a couple guys, and they all said the exact same thing. Why me? I'm boring. I go to work. I've got a family. I'm changing diapers. I'm running to baseball practice. Why would you want me to be in a documentary? I say, you are amazing. You represent something that's not being talked about. And they all reluctantly agreed to do this because they don't think of themselves as anything great. But in my world and in my perspective, they are.
Oh, and absolutely. And more importantly, in the lives of their children, they are great men. And the investment they're making, and some were looking back on raising children, others were in the midst of raising children, that investment is priceless.
And we wanted to share that. We wanted guys who are different parts in the journey, guys who are just starting out with the newborn babies, and they're still in the diaper phase. Mm-hmm. And you've got the other guys who are grandfathers, and that perspective needs to be shared. I think we're seeing less and less of that generational knowledge being shared from men to men.
Now, some of the men that are featured, they admit that the relationship they had with their fathers was not healthy. It was a disappointment. And yet these are men who have made serious commitments about how they're going to raise their children, how they're going to invest time and spend time in the lives of their sons and daughters. So it even demonstrated that regardless of how you were fathered, you can be a father who does a great job and loves their children well.
That makes me think of Aaron White, who he's a youth pastor in the inner city in L.A. He did not grow up with the dad, even though his dad lived a few minutes away from him. So when he got married, he had no idea what a dad does. He had no idea what that looks like. He had no template. He had no role model. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the things that amazes me about him, is that he said, I will do whatever it takes. No matter what, I will figure this thing out. I will read books. I will listen to podcasts. I will resource myself so that my daughter can have a dad, the kind of dad that I never had. And I think that quality is admirable. Someone who's going to do whatever it takes to be that dad for that child.
Well, and it is a picture of what is possible, because far too many young men have not had the benefit of that kind of fatherhood. And they too can begin a change in the line of their family. They change the culture of family.
Absolutely.
in their line.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I like about these guys that I have in Honor Project documentary, is they come from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. They all look different. As you notice, their skin color, everyone's different. The age is different. These guys represent so many different facets of life. And we wanted to show that the thing that they have in common, even though they're all really different, is they're all dads.
Yeah.
So being a dad looks really different. And as you can see, everyone parents really differently. And that's great. That's great. But they're all showing up.
Yeah. And they share that commitment to their sons and daughters. Now, let me ask you why a single woman with no film background decided to create a documentary film. I mean, you are an author. You could have written their stories. Why did you think this format that was new to you was the best way to give them the opportunity to tell their stories?
I did not want to try to take these guys, these men who are in my lives, these friends of mine, and try to sum them up in written word. There's no way that I could have done that. And I wanted to let them speak for themselves. I wanted to ask them the questions. I want to interview them. I wanted to show them with their family. This is what this looks like. I could have never done that through a book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I enjoyed seeing their personalities, how they communicated, seeing their children, getting a glimpse of their family life. And I think that really fills out the story and, again, makes it more possible for other men to see themselves in their success.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Now, your story weaves back and forth between your own father and the stories of these other men. Tell us a little bit about your dad. I have to admit, when I saw him in the documentary, I immediately thought, oh, he's fun. I would love to know him. He's, he's a character.
Yes, growing up was never a dull moment with my dad. He was the kind of guy who, I have two sisters, and even as far back as elementary school, he would always tell us, you are just as pretty, smart, and capable as everyone else. And so we just believed him. That's it. He would say things like, protect yourself at all times, be on your best behavior, and never be afraid to throw the first punch. And again, we're in elementary school. We're not punching anybody. What do you mean throw the first punch? But he would ingrain these things into us that without pushing back, we didn't know any different. He would say things like, bad things happen to good people. And when your moment comes, you need to be ready. And of course, we roll our eyes like, oh my gosh, Dad, you've been saying that forever. Well, a couple of years ago, I was mugged at a bank. I had just come off work. I was taking care of some business at the bank, and I was attacked at the bank. Well, the next thing I know, I'm chasing after the guy. The next thing I know, I catch up to the guy. The next thing, we're on the ground. I'm putting the guy in a rear naked choke. I'm putting him in a headlock. Now, I'm not into that kung fu. I don't do karate. I don't do that. But my dad and I probably have watched too many UFC videos where it just kind of came out of me. But people ask me, are you traumatized? Are you okay? Are you ever going to go back to that bank? Are you okay? You know, what's going on? And my answer is absolutely yes, because I grew up being told that bad things happen to good people. And I was prepared for that. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the next thing I knew, I was Jason Bourne with Bourne identity skills. But that moment came and went. And I have to attribute that to my dad. And I walk today, I'm still confident. I don't look over my shoulder and not fearful. And I really do attribute that to my own dad.
Mm. Well, that's a remarkable story. The perpetrator, was he caught by law enforcement? What happened there?
One of those, you know, local drug dealer gang member kind of guys. I don't know what I was doing trying to put him in a chokehold. But yeah, when the police came to take the report, you know, I'm in high heels. I had just come from work. And the police officer, who was really cute, I'm trying to like be cool, tell my story. He's like, what happened next? I was like, oh, I put him in a chokehold. He sets down his pad of paper. It's like, wait, you put him in a chokehold? Oh my gosh, I can't even believe you. So it was actually funny.
Oh my goodness. Now that would make a movie right there. Men are underappreciated. In fact, they are oftentimes the brunt of a joke, you know, that men are sort of unnecessary to the life of women and children. Your documentary tells the other side of that story, really a story that is a non-story.
Yeah. And from the moment that I started talking about doing a documentary on men, I started feeling heat. I started getting feedback. Again, I live in Los Angeles, where it's not really popular to be supportive of men or dads. It's really popular to be a feminist and to be a bit angry and to be a bit edgy, of which I don't consider myself a feminist at all. But this story needs to be told, because for me, this is it. This is average. This is regular life. I didn't know until I was in college that there's this thing called a glass ceiling, because that wasn't my world. And so again, this documentary, this is my world. These are personal friends of mine. This is my own dad. This is my world. And I would love for people to see what my world looks like, because I think it represents a lot of other men that are out there that they're probably rolling their eyes and thinking, I'm just a regular guy. There's nothing special about me. And those are the exact kind of guys who are making families. They're providing for their families. They're supporting their kids. They're doing the work.
Yeah, their stories are not being told.
Yeah.
Well, they are being told in this project. The Honor Project documentary, The Road to Fatherhood, is an adventure. We're going to continue our conversation with Emily Hibbard in just a moment, but I do need to take a quick break. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Emily Hibbard. She's an author. She's a documentary film maker. She's an executive producer and narrator of The Honor Project. The Road to Fatherhood is an adventure, and I think every man in the audience who's raising a family or has raised one is nodding their head. That is so the case. And what a wonderful opportunity to hear a series of positive stories about men who have just made the decision, I'm putting my kids first. And I love that some of these men talk about the fact that having that child changed everything for them. Their whole orientation shifted. And it's so true for many men who parent their children. And it's wonderful to hear these men in their own words tell that story.
Yeah, I think I saw that particularly with the question. We interviewed all the guys, and when I would ask the guys to define masculinity, they all, you know, their eyes kind of ping pong balled out, and they looked at me like, "Em, I'm not supposed to answer that. I'm supposed to back away from that." And after a little coaxing, they would answer. But their definition was generally very similar to one another. And they said when they were younger, high school, college age, their definition of masculinity was being in the gym 3-5 days a week. It was being strong. It was being buff. It was showing everyone that I'm a tough guy. And then as they started getting married, as they started having kids, well, it didn't really matter how buff they were because they have this crying little kid over here and nothing in the world's gonna hurt this kid. And their definition of masculinity internalized. Mm-hmm. And so when they were younger, it was more all about them. And as they're getting older, it was more about their kids.
I love the phrase that one of them used, quietly providing and fixing, which is a great definition of what these fathers were doing. And they were engaged with their kids. They're running after them. They're playing with them. They were spending time with them. It was really quite refreshing. In the midst of all of this, what did you find were some of the greatest struggles and frustrations that these men sharing this one thing in common shared with you?
They don't have much of an outlet. And I think this is common throughout the country. 15 of the 20 guys in the documentary are Christians. There's not a lot of options for these men to get involved in their church. A lot of these churches, they don't have a big men's ministry. Mm-hmm. Their churches are basically being run by women. And so they kind of don't want to get involved with that because that's, you know, all the grannies and all the ladies are doing that. There's not a lot of options for guys that we're seeing in churches. And that's a real struggle for them. So this documentary was recruiting these similar guys, and they really found a sense of community with one another, even though they're all spread out. Some of the guys know each other, most of them don't. But there's not a lot of outlets for guys who are Christians who just want to be regular guys, mm-hmm. and parenting is a big priority to them. They're often doing it alone.
That's a really interesting point, because I think for a lot of men who are in the faith and want to have that kind of outlet, that kind of fellowship with other men who have similar obligations and commitments, that's a void that perhaps this documentary will help fill by shining a light on that need.
Yeah. From the second this came out, we started getting contacted by Christian men, churches, different faith-based groups saying, "What else do you have?" Well, what do you mean, what else do we have? We just released this documentary on Father's Day. So actually, we're in the process of putting together a small group study for men. And it's going to be 10 episodes that is going to dive right into issues that Christian men want to talk about. They want to talk about love. They want to talk about forgiveness. They want to talk about masculinity. But there's not really a place to do that. And so we'll launch it, you know, by them watching the documentary, by showing, hey, here's 20 guys who are doing this. And then dive into a more faith-based curriculum for them to just talk that through.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned that you asked them how they would define masculinity. And the phrase toxic masculinity has become overused and perhaps misunderstood in our culture. But these men, as you point out, you say that they want to really reclaim masculinity, to define it in a way that's certainly for the men of faith, that is consistent with what it means to be a man of faith and a father. Any specific answers to that reclaiming of masculinity that I think the culture is desperate for but doesn't really hear much about?
For the Christian men, clearly their role model, their definition of masculinity is Jesus Christ. And that's very evident through their lives. That's it. These men who have made that decision, who are raising Christian children, even though that is their definition of masculinity, there's still not a lot of outlets. Mm-hmm. It's not politically correct to say that. It's not politically correct for a guy to say, "I embrace my masculinity." And so although these guys who are amazing define themselves like that, the lack of outlets makes it really challenging for them.
What kind of response have you been getting from the documentary, given the fact that it's a very touchy subject in our culture today, and to suggest that there are healthy men who are raising their children, to emphasize the fact that their children need them, need their fathers? How has this been received thus far?
Overwhelmingly far more emotional than I ever imagined, from men and from women. Every single guy who has watched this that's over 50 is in tears. And there's something that silences me when I see a guy, especially an older gentleman, with tears in his eyes watching that, because he relates oftentimes to the baby boomer dads. Mm-hmm. Everyone relates to someone in the documentary. And that, I never imagined that. I never imagined that it can touch so many people, men and women. it makes me think of one of the guys in the documentary, Malik Murray. We had a screening in Los Angeles at a place called the Hoving Home, and it is a residential program. It's faith-based for women who are struggling with drug addiction. So we showed the documentary there, and then afterwards just did a Q&A. It was him with the 30 residents of that home, and he asked the question, how many women here grew up with, you know, an average dad? No one raised their hand. He thought, oh, I missed. They didn't understand what I was saying. So he rephrased the question. And sure enough, not one of the women in those program or the staff members grew up with what they would define as an average dad. And he about lost it. He about came to tears realizing, I'm standing in front of these women and I'm like a unicorn because I'm telling them that this thing exists that none of them have seen before. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. It's unscripted. He's asking questions. He's answering questions on the fly. Simple, simple, simple questions. But these women, none of the women in the home or the staff have ever met a guy like Malik Murray. Mm. And we're seeing that over and over and over with every screening.
Well, that tells you so much about the culture we find ourselves in and how desperately we are in need of men who take their fatherhood seriously.
Yeah.
Oh, that just breaks my heart. We're talking about the documentary. It's simply titled The Honor Project. The Road to Fatherhood is an Adventure. And these are men telling their own stories. In fact, you narrate the documentary, but I don't know that there are any other women who speak throughout. If I recall, these are men telling their story. I mean, to get a group of men in their natural habitat to tell their stories, to get them to talk. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable feat right there.
Yeah.
But to tell their stories well and to remind us of how important what they're doing and what other men are doing and that other men are doing that is so important to encourage other men and women, for that matter, that they're out there and they're not the unicorn that, you know, at least popular entertainment and media would have us believe.
Yeah. Yeah. These men and even the men in the documentary having been, we'll say, highlighted in this documentary, because again, all of them consider themselves to be just average guys. Mm-hmm. And now they have this renewed understanding of who I am as a man, who I am as a husband, who I am as a father, as a neighbor, as a pastor, as a guy at church affects everyone around me. And I don't think they realized that before. No. And so since the documentary has come out and they're getting, you know, lots of exposure and lots of questions, they're really rising to the occasion even more so. And that's, I'm really excited to see what's in store for them.
One of the things I hope, too, is that men who see the documentary will sense this, but others who see it will also recognize their value. I think they're undervalued, those who are faithfully and quietly serving their families in unique ways. And the generations that they're raising will have an impact on the world. And we don't know where those kids might end up at some point in the future. But that investment, as I mentioned early, really is priceless. And maybe this will help them recognize their value because someone is saying, this is an important story. Your story is important enough to be told.
Yeah, I am for men. I support you. Like, for all the men that are listening to this, we're not a bunch of feminists out there that are trying to beat you down. We understand submission and we understand the biblical God-given role for men. And we want that. We support you. We are for you.
Absolutely. We want to honor you. Now, you traveled with your father to the Arctic Ocean for your documentary, the lengths to which you were willing to go. What do you respect the most about your dad? And what are some of his your best memories of growing up with him?
Oh, my gosh. Well, let me just tell you this. So when we're doing the documentary, I said, Dad, I'm doing a documentary on dads, you know. And he goes, okay, for my part, I want to drive to the Arctic. Well, what do you mean for your part? It's a documentary. I'm going to follow you around. He's like, oh, no. I want to drive to the Arctic. It's 3,700 miles from here. I'm going to take the Land Cruiser. He had it all planned out in a second. He had it all planned out. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is so my dad. So we did. We drove up to the Arctic Ocean. About 10 years ago, him and I had both kayaked in Antarctica. So you can kind of get the feel for our relationship. I definitely get my adventurous spirit from my dad, again, the type of guy who's like, let's try it out. Let's see. No one goes to the Arctic. Let's go. And I grew up with that. And I think I'm the result of that. You mentioned, you know, some of my education, things that, you know, that I've done. And I have to attribute that to my dad growing up in a family, being told that I can do it and I'm just as smart and pretty as everyone else. Well, I believed the guy. And, you know, so come high school, come college, come whatever it was, an opportunity would present itself and I jump in. And a lot of women wouldn't because they didn't have the confidence. And I didn't know any different. I didn't know any different because I had a dad who I didn't know there was an option. Of course you can give it a try.
Yeah. And I was blessed to have a father that that was committed to his family. I was a daddy's girl. I loved my, he's now passed away, but I feel so blessed to have had a father who was supportive of his family. And yeah. I wouldn't be who I am today without the support and encouragement from my father. So for those who have not had that experience, it's incredible. And for those men who can't imagine that they can provide that experience for their kids, let me encourage you. It's possible. You don't have to come from a stellar household to create a stellar household. And the men in these stories have different beginnings. And some of them started out with no father at all, or a kind of a shaky relationship with their fathers.
Yeah.
But all of them are investing in their families. And it's remarkable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for women that are like you and like me that have had positive, wonderful relationships with dads, there's no other voices out there. This is a perfect time right now to take that opportunity. Yeah. Post on Instagram, post on Twitter, post on Facebook, post a picture of your dad, post a memory. There's things that we can do, even in social media, that we can do to honor men, to honor dads,
yes.
to get that out there. There's no competition for it. And because it's so different than what we're hearing right now, it really stands out.
Yeah.
Even just the few things that I post about my dad, I get huge responses to it. Not because it's the most stellar thing. I mean, you know, whatever, dad's dad. But because no one else is saying that.
Yeah.
When people watch Honor Project documentary, I would love two things to happen. I would love to see forgiveness come back. Mm. There's a lot of men and women out there who grew up with dads that may not have had the type of dads that, you know, that we did. But forgiveness leaves the enemy empty-handed. When we forgive our dads for not being what we thought they might have, you know, they should have done or should have been, when we forgive, it has so much power.
That's right.
The second thing I'd like to see is for honor to come back. Both women and men have the ability to honor men. We can honor our fathers, our husbands, our brothers, our neighbors, the guy who carries those heavy UPS packages or our, you know, latest Amazon buy. We can honor men. I'd love to see honor get a comeback.
Well, again, the project is called Honor Project Documentary. The Road to Fatherhood is an Adventure. How can our listeners acquire a copy?
Go to honorprojectmovie.com. Yeah, get the DVD or download it.
I would encourage you to do just that. Love these guys. And again, was very encouraged by their stories. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Again, Emily Hibbard, she's an author, a documentary filmmaker, an executive producer, and the narrator of The Honor Project. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
We're back. You're listening to the final segment of the Georgine Rice Show. Well, Turkish President Erdogan is overseeing the laying of a foundation stone for the nation's first new church since 1923. Well, the Turkish president oversaw this ceremonial laying of the cornerstone, the foundation stone for the construction of this new church in nearly a century. In the ceremony, it was held on Saturday in Istanbul. He celebrated the beginning of construction for the church, which is going to serve as the local Syriac Christian community and is going to be the first new church built there since the nation became a republic in 1923. He offered some remarks at the ceremony, and he championed tolerance for minority communities in the Muslim-majority nation, and he declared that this country, this state, belongs to everyone, end quote. It is the Turkish Republic's duty to meet the needs for space to worship for the Syriac community, who are the ancient children of this geography. Anyone who has affection for, contributes to, and is loyal to Turkey is a first-class citizen. There are no barriers to anyone in politics, trade, or any other area. The church will be constructed in the Istanbul neighborhood of Yesilkoy. It's located in one of the municipalities there. And according to Erdogan, the church should be completed within the next 2 years. Plans to construct the church were first announced back in January of this year. The Syriac Orthodox Church is metropolitan for Istanbul, and the capital Ankara supported that decision. So this is big news for Turkey and for the body of Christ in general, saying we're proud of living under the Turkish flag in this land, said the metropolitan, as reported by the local news agency, also saying that everyone's heartbeat is for Turkey. Well, the Syriac Christian community is going to be paying for the building. It's expected to have a sanctuary with space for approximately 700 believers. My prayer is they'll outgrow it almost right away. Erdogan had a controversial record when it comes to religious freedom for the Islamic country's small Christian minority. Last year, the government garnered negative international attention, you might recall, for its detaining of American pastor Andrew Brunson under allegations that he was connected to a terrorist group that engaged in a failed coup in 2016. Well, Brunson, who lived in Turkey for more than 20 years as a minister, was eventually freed after 2 years in prison, returned to the United States after the Trump administration demanded his release. Well, in a hearing held back in June by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, Brunson expressed his concerns that Christian persecution was on the rise in Turkey. There is still a high degree of freedom for Christians relative to other Muslim countries in the region, but I am concerned that all the signs point to this changing soon. So there is an asterisk to this new sanctuary being built by the U.S. pastor who was held prisoner there. He went on to say, I think there are a number of people in the Turkish church who, as they see a lot of foreign Christians being expelled from the country, who are very concerned about what is going to happen to them. So while this is certainly good news for the Syriac church and the building of this singular facility, it doesn't necessarily point to a growing freedom in that country. Taking a look at what's coming up for the remainder of this week on the Georgine Rice Show. Tomorrow, I'm looking forward to a conversation with Alex Kendrick. He and his brother are producers of Overcomer. The movie is coming out later this month. We'll talk with them about that. They also have some other resources, some books that they recently released, and maybe we'll have an opportunity to touch on that. We're also going to talk with Mark Moore. His book is titled Core 52, a 15-minute daily guide to build your Bible IQ in a year. Of course, there are 52 weeks in the year, and you can do the math. One would hope more than 15 minutes a day one would spend in God's Word, but this is to help you understand and to better navigate and understand the structure of the Bible, its history, and so on in those 52 weeks. Mark Moore will join me to talk about that on Tuesday. Then on Wednesday, Chris Bruno will be my guest. His book is titled Paul versus James, What We've Been Missing in the Faith and Works Debate. And that debate will not end as a result of our conversation, but will contribute something to it in our his visit with me on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, Dr. Stephen Kello will be my guest. Walk with Jesus on Campus, How to Care for Your Soul During College. So if you are a college student, if you're anticipating starting college soon, this is a great resource for you. It's easy to get wrapped up in academics to the exclusion of all else. And this is an effort to help those who are committed to their walk with Christ to do both things well, to pursue academic studies and do well, as well as to continue to build and develop your faith. So that's Stephen Kello. Dr. Kello will be my guest. Walk with Jesus on Campus, How to Care for Your Soul During College. All right, well, we are just about out of time. Want to thank James Blend for producing today's program, Clark Hilton for engineering. Also, if you're interested in the Honor Project, just simply go online, Honor Project, the movie, and you can find all the important details there. In fact, some of the fathers are pictured on the cover, not all 20, but several of them. And you can find the Honor Project documentary, The Road to Fatherhood is an Adventure. You might want to share that with some men in your life you want to encourage and inspire. All right, out of time. Thank you for listening and making the Georgine Rice Show part of your day. Hope you'll join us here tomorrow. Alex Kendrick will join us. Overcomer, the movie, coming out later this month. And Mark Moore, Core 52, a 15-minute daily guide to build your Bible IQ in a year. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at @GRiceShow and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn.
deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.